Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're digging into something pretty immense, 233 years of change, constant change. And we're looking at it through the New York Stock Exchange. We've got this fascinating presentation mapping out financial market history, you know, from 18th century debt chaos right up to today's AI race, private capital, all of that.
Yeah, it's really a study in resilience, isn't it? I mean, how does an institution last that long? It's not about avoiding change, clearly, it's about managing it. And what we see time and again is that finance innovates based on really three things: regulation, where the money's flowing, and how markets themselves evolve. So our mission here is to track how crises, both old and very new, actually force these leaps forward.
Okay, let's jump right in. American finance beginnings. It's kind of contradictory, this history. The sources highlight this core paradox. We Americans, we apparently hate taxes enough to start a revolution,
yes.
Right? But we seem to really, really love debt.
Huh, yes. That love of debt, or maybe need for it, is basically the foundation. After kicking out the British, the U.S. government borrowed, what, $54 million from France for the war? And just think about that number today. It's like $14 trillion. For a brand new country, mostly farms, no real industry, terrible credit rating, just staggering debt, plus states issuing their own paper.
Total chaos. Zero confidence. So then Alexander Hamilton steps up, looks at this mess, basically worthless IOUs everywhere, and proposes something, well, pretty radical for the time.
Totally radical. He says, let's nationalize it. Take all that state debt, the continental debt, everything, put it under the federal government, and crucially promise to pay it back at face value. Now, that promise was the game changer, because most people holding that debt, you know, veterans paid in IOUs, they thought it was junk, worthless. Suddenly, maybe it wasn't. And boom, speculation starts.
Right. And that brings in characters like William Dorr. He was connected, an administration insider. Got wind of Hamilton's plan early.
Exactly. Dorr sees this junk paper might actually be worth something.
Yeah.
He starts borrowing like crazy, trying to buy it all up cheap from people out in the countryside who hadn't heard the news. And the sources give this great picture, right? Trading wasn't on some fancy floor. It was informal. In bars, taverns, down in lower Manhattan. Prices apparently went up after a couple of cocktails.
Love that detail. Mm. But Dorr sounds like he was a gambler, maybe got ahead of himself. Borrowed too much.
Yeah, he ran out of money, couldn't cover his bets, basically. And when he defaulted, that triggered the first U.S. financial crisis, 1792, a real panic.
Okay, so crisis breeds order. The brokers who got burned in that crash, they decide enough is enough.
Precisely. 24 of them in New York City. They'd lost money, seen the chaos, they needed rules. So they met, famously, under a buttonwood tree on a street called, well, Wall Street, named after an actual wall back then.
And they didn't just pick a spot. They created, like, the foundational rules for trust, didn't they?
That's the core of it. Four basic rules. One, agree on one place to trade. Two, agree on set trading times. Three, agree on commissions, no price gouging. And four, maybe the most important, agree to only trade with each other. That created this exclusive club, sure, but it guaranteed you knew who was on the other side of the trade. They wouldn't just disappear if things went bad. Built in trust. Self-regulation from day one.
And that's a key difference from, say, Amsterdam at the time.
Huge difference. In Amsterdam, you generally had to be a merchant, part of the guild. Here, the idea was more about democratization. Anyone, theoretically, could participate. Bring your risk, join the market, but play by the rules. That combo, open access plus guaranteed trust, that's really the American model. And you see how need drives innovation. They started outside, under a tree. But needing to trade indoors reliably led to things like, believe it or not, air conditioning and vacuum tubes being developed for the NYSE floor.
That's amazing. Necessity really is the mother of invention, even for AC. Okay, let's fast forward. Modern change. It's not just tech, it's culture too.
Oh, absolutely profound shifts. I mean, think about it. Women couldn't even trade on the floor until 1960. And the exchange didn't get a women's restroom until 1965. Fast forward to today, the president is Lynn Martin, and the kinds of companies listing.
Yeah, the sources mentioned Grainger going public. That signals a massive cultural shift in acceptance, something unthinkable not that long ago.
Definitely. But change also bubbles up from the clients, the users, like the story of Barry McCarthy. He was involved with Netflix's IPO, then later CFO at Spotify, and he apparently hated the traditional IPO process.
Really? Mm. What was his beef with it?
He called it complete alchemy. Felt the pricing was arbitrary, disconnected from the business, and crucially, he had no control over it. It just happened to him. His frustration was basically the 21st century version of those brokers under the buttonwood tree saying, there has to be a better way.
And the exchange actually listened.
They did. That pressure led to the direct listing, created in 2018. Spotify used it, Slack, ZipRecruiter. It's an alternative path to public markets, driven directly by client demand. Shows that evolution is still happening.
And speaking of needing better ways, let's talk COVID-19. That must have been an existential test, right? For a place built on people gathering.
Absolutely. A customer-facing business, as they put it, suddenly having to shut its iconic trading floor for, what, 6 weeks? That hits right at the core identity. A huge challenge.
So how did they handle it? What does that tell us about trust in a crisis?
It really highlights that human element, even now. Technology kept the trades flowing, obviously, but they needed to maintain community trust. So they brought in Scott Gottlieb, you know, the immunologist, former FDA head, to give daily credible health updates to everyone. That human guidance was vital.
Interesting. So even when you can trade from anywhere, that central hub provides something else. Communication. Stability.
Yeah, trust and communication in a panic. It still matters.
Okay, let's pivot now to the elephant in the room, AI. This feels like the ultimate paradox right now. Are we looking at a huge bubble, or is this something totally different? Let's start with the warning signs.
Well, the alarms are definitely ringing for some analysts. You see classic bubble talk triggers. Market concentration is one huge flag. And valuations. The S&P 500 trading at 24 times forward earnings.
Okay, break that down. 24 times forward earnings. Why is that number making people nervous?
It basically means investors are paying $24 now for every $1 of profit they expect those companies to make over the next year. And 24 times, that's historically very, very high. Higher than the dot-com peak for the S&P, higher than even during COVID's weird market. It suggests expectations are maybe stretched.
Stretched. And beyond that multiple, you've got this concentration issue, these giant, almost circular deals like OpenAI needing massive infrastructure from NVIDIA, AMD, Oracle, plus the Magnificent 10, or whatever we call them now. They make up something like 40% of the S&P 500's value, which is 10% of all global stocks.
Yeah, it's an incredibly crowded trade. Everyone's in the same names. And you're seeing risk creep into the credit markets, too. Lots of high-yield, kind of risky debt being issued to build all these data centers. So, okay, that's the bubble case history would point to. But then you have to look at the other side, the sheer scale of the investment. It's just off the charts.
Right. And this is where the numbers get kind of mind-blowing. This isn't just typical investment. The top players, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Meta, they've ramped up their capital spending, their CapEx, 6 times over in just 3 years.
Their current annual spending is $365 billion just on CapEx. To put that in perspective for you, that's more than the combined budgets of the U.S. State Department, NASA, and the Department of Energy combined.
Wow, that comparison really hits home. And they're not stopping. The future plans are even bigger.
That's the projection. Over the next 5 years, the plan is to spend $3 trillion. $3 trillion dedicated to essentially one idea, building out AI infrastructure. You just didn't see that level of focused capital commitment during the space race or the internet build out or cloud or mobile. Nothing compares. It suggests the belief that AI isn't just another tech cycle. It's like a fundamental utility being built. That's the argument against it being just a bubble.
But there's always a but, isn't there? The productivity isn't showing up yet in the broad economy, that lag.
Exactly. We overestimate the short term, underestimate the long term. Mobile is the classic proxy, right? iPhone comes out in 07. What did people do first? Replace their iPod, maybe their flip phone. The real productivity explosion, Uber, DoorDash, the whole app economy that took a few years. Didn't really kick in until 2009, 2010.
And wasn't there that study about the early internet? Computers in offices in the late 80s.
Yeah, Paul David's work. Initially, computers were just used for, well, typing memos faster, duplicating old ways of working. The big productivity gains only came maybe 4 or 5 years later once computers were networked, running collaborative software, changing how work was done. So the takeaway seems to be, yes, valuations look stretched now, short-term frothiness is likely, but that unprecedented capital commitment, it suggests there's enormous long-term potential once we figure out how to actually integrate AI into everything. We're in that lag phase.
Okay, so AI is soaking up huge public capital. But what about the capital that doesn't hit the public markets? Let's talk about private capital. That feels like another massive structural shift.
Oh, it's monumental. And yes, fundamentals still matter, but the whole private market ecosystem has definitely changed the game. Companies can and do stay private much, much longer now. Why? Well, a big part was 2 decades of super low, near zero interest rates. That flooded the system with capital looking for higher returns, pushing money into riskier things like venture capital and private equity.
And the scale needed for businesses today, tech, energy, industrials, is often huge, right? Private markets can supply that kind of patient, large-scale capital without the quarterly pressures of being public.
Exactly. And look at the growth. Private equity assets, AUM, back in the 90s, it was maybe $7.5 billion. Tiny. Yeah. Today, it's $3 trillion. Venture capital went from maybe $1.5 billion in 1990 to nearly $2 trillion now. That's a vast pool of capital operating outside the traditional IPO route.
Which leads to this really significant societal point the sources raise. Historically, how did average people build wealth? Mostly real estate and the stock market, right? But if the next big tech company stays private for 10, 15 years, growing massively during that time, yeah, the public completely misses out on that early wealth creation phase.
That's the crux of the societal challenge. It potentially widens the wealth gap. And it's why you hear all this debate now about changing the rules, allowing regular folks to put some of their 401k money into private equity, for instance. Right now, big pension funds, defined benefit plans, they might have a third of their assets in these alternatives, your typical 401k, maybe 1%. It's a huge disparity in access.
Okay, so we've got AI uncertainty, this massive shift to private capital. Forget geopolitics for a second. When you talk to insiders, what's the financial risk that really keeps them awake at night?
It really comes down to the credit markets. Specifically, that enormous, rapidly growing slice of lending that's happening within private capital. Private debt, it's largely outside the direct oversight of the Fed and the traditional banking regulators. If something goes wrong there, if there's a major default or blow up in private credit, the ripple effects could be huge, and the usual tools might not reach it effectively. That lack of transparency, that's the systemic worry.
That's a really crucial point. Okay, let's bring it back home. We started with this 233-year-old institution. Looking back, what are the absolute core principles that allow something like the NYSE to endure through all this?
Seems like three main things. One, know your core mission. For them, it's democratizing finance, bringing buyers and sellers together efficiently. Stick to that. Two, evolve with technology constantly. AC, vacuum tubes, direct listings, electronic trading, adopt it all. But crucially, never lose the human judgment, the strategy, the oversight. Tech is a tool, not the master.
And the third pillar sounds like it loops right back to 1792 and those brokers under the tree.
Trust has to be trust. It's everything. The example they gave was Bank of New York been a listed client for 232 years straight. You only get that kind of longevity if people fundamentally trust the market, trust the rules, trust the institution itself. It's the bedrock.
Before we wrap, there was some personal advice in the materials, like what you tell your younger self. That really ties into this whole theme.
Yeah, I liked that part. The advice was basically, give yourself flexibility and durability, because life, as they put it, throws a whole bunch of shit at you. Unexpected stuff, always. And that ability to adapt, to pivot, to change course, that's the most valuable human skill there is. They told that anecdote about Jeremy. Failed 4 times, bankrupt 3 times. Then his fifth company IPOs, and boom, he's worth $3 billion overnight. That's durability personified. Keep adapting.
Wow. What a journey. Okay, so this deep dive went from 18th century debt to AI bubbles to private credit risks. It really puts today's market craziness into a much longer perspective, which you really need right now.
Absolutely. And we talked a lot about trust, tech, democratization, building this, you know, established financial system.
Yeah.
So here's the final thought I want to leave you with. Think about crypto, digital assets. Where did that really come from? Largely from a lack of trust in the system, right?
Yeah.
Especially after the 2008 crisis, Occupy Wall Street, that whole vibe.
Yeah, and it's incredibly democratized in a different way. Like 65% of Bitcoin holders are just individuals. It bypasses so many of the intermediaries we just discussed.
So the question to ponder is, how does this parallel system built on individual belief, decentralized, born from distrust, how does it ultimately interact with the centralized trust-based system we've spent all this time analyzing? What does its existence tell us about where trust and money itself might be heading?
A very provocative question indeed. Something to definitely think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.